Welcome back, everyone, to the Legends of Sport podcast. I'm your host, as always, Andy Bernstein. And I am thrilled, beyond thrilled, to be bringing this guest to you on this episode today. This guest is an 8-time Olympic medalist, 3 different Olympic Games. He's the most decorated U.S. Winter Olympian in history, the great Apollo Ohno. Apollo was best known for his short track speed skating prowess, and he brought those talents from the ice, off the ice, as he leads the way in discussion about mental health, financial literacy, and everything that we talked about today, which was so fascinating. Can't wait for you guys to get into this podcast. So without further ado, here he is, Apollo Ohno, and I'll see you on the backside. I want to welcome Apollo Ohno to the Legends of Sport podcast. You know, I follow your Instagram like almost religiously, and it seems like you're in a different place like every day. I mean, you're like hiking, you're in Miami, you're in Mexico, you're at the Olympic Training Center. I mean, you just can't stay put, or you just have a crazy schedule, or what?
I travel a lot. I mean, look, during kind of the height of the pandemic, I didn't travel at all. And so that's where most of the hiking pictures came from, was just me kind of exploring California. But for the most part, I typically travel like over 250 days a year, I think on average. And then I would say about 3 years ago, I would spend less than 6 weeks a year in the U.S. Actually, I was spending a lot of time overseas. So I personally am like really looking forward to traveling again. For me, I get a lot of energy from people just flying and learning and growing. And so I'm starting to get that energy again, but it's been a long time.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, I didn't travel at all this year during the NBA season once it started back up. The last trip I made was coming back from the NBA bubble. I was there for 53 days, which was quite the test of psychological fortitude, to say the least. Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. But, you know, Apollo, you know, obviously I know about your career. I followed your career. I never got to shoot you, you know, competing, which kind of sucks because I never did a lot of Winter Olympic sports. It's too cold for me. I don't know. Being a New Yorker, I don't know why, but I just never did. I was stuck more indoor, like with hockey and basketball and stuff. But
I'm an indoor sport. Indoor.
No, it's true. But I don't think you have heat in the place where you compete. So that's
It depends on which part of the world we're competing in. If we're like competing somewhere in Slovakia, sometimes I feel like inside their ice rink is colder than it is outside. And I'm like, how is this actually possible?
Really? So I was interested to read, and we did a plethora, we deep dive of research, and that you were a swimmer as a kid before you took up speed skating. Like, what was that all about? And what was that transition like?
Well, I was a swimmer. I played all traditional American stick and ball sports. I did swimming. You named it. I've tried it when I was growing up as a kid, not really by choice, but merely because my father and I grew up in a single parent household. So my father raised me my entire life, and my father has to work all day and he needs some type of positive activities that he could place his son into consistently. And sport was my outlet to really direct and kind of funnel where all that excess energy was going to go towards. And so I did all these different sports, and swimming was one of those sports where I picked it up very quickly. So at the age of like 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I was constantly kind of winning in my hometown of Seattle, and became state champion. And my dad had all these like big dreams and aspirations of me getting a full ride to like Michigan or Stanford or one of these other kind of, you know, prolific swimming institutions, so to speak, along with having a great university background. I didn't know any of those things and what that meant. And I never really actually liked swimming. And I remember I went to the national championships and I saw like these kids whose arms span. I mean, they just were freakish athletes, like in the best way possible. And it was I was pretty quick to learn that that probably was not going to be my sport of choice.
Yeah. So how did speed skating come into your sort of on your radar? Where did that come from?
I saw speed skating for the first time in the 1992 Olympic Games, and then again in the 1994 Olympic Games. And I fell in love with the sport. You know, I grew up in the Seattle region. My father would drive me back and forth after seeing those games to Vancouver, which is about 3.5 hours door to door from my house. And so in Vancouver, BC, in Canada, I would watch these speed skaters skate inside of an ice hockey rink. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was fast. It was exhilarating. It was really volatile. It was crazy. And at the time, they looked like they were superhero figures. And I always tell this story because as like a young, you know, 12 and 13 and 14-year-old, to me, there was like no difference between these athletes leaning over these impossible angles, wearing those samurai swords on their feet. So I fell in love almost instantly. And I had a really fast, call it a learning process. So I could see someone effectively skating, and I thought internally I could copy that right away. I could mimic what I saw. So I learned very well through the visual process, and I learned by watching those athletes in Canada and then kind of replicating what I saw in my head and visualizing that and then putting that expression onto the ice.
It's such a dangerous sport though, right? I mean, I can't imagine as a dad, like watching my kid, like, you know, inches from injury or death. I mean, it, you know, I get excited when I watch my kid play soccer and I'm like, don't kick her, you know, just get hit in the head, and she's only 13. But the fear involved, the danger of it, was that a lure as well, that sport? Because, you know, I know you've talked about that you had a fear of failure as a kid, but what about fear of fear? Did that enter into the equation at all?
I never had fear in the sport. I think that's maybe the reason why I skated so aggressively at certain times. And but you know, the fear component was gone because effectively my dad was saying, you can't be a boxer, professional boxer. I'm not going to allow you to play football. And so those are some pretty hard hitting, rough sports, right? Both involving like pretty severe head trauma and injury. And plus those, like those humans are like built out of granite, and I wasn't. So I'm pretty sure that I wouldn't have lasted very long in the NFL if it could even get to that point. And my dad said no anyway. So speed skating at the time looked like it was a pretty safe sport. Although when we first started out, it was, you know, we lost about half our team because we didn't have the proper padding system inside the hockey rink. We used to like go get these like old mattresses and basically tape them together on the inside of a hockey rink. You know, because if you fall and you crash into those boards, there's no like cushion there. So
yeah. You sound like Tony Hawk when I talked to him on the podcast, and he goes, yeah, you know, we put a couple of mattresses down and we're jumping off the roof of the garage. And I'm like, dude, okay. Anyway,
so yeah, we were very lucky, not to luckily with crazy injuries. Very lucky.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. One of the big reasons I wanted to talk to you is because when I was in the NBA bubble last summer and suffering, one of the things that really helped me get through it was watching the Weight of Gold documentary on HBO. And then I was so enthralled and so taken back by just everything, the production of it, the honesty, you know, the A-list athletes that were represented, that I reached out to Brett Rapkin, the director, cold. I DM'd him, I think, or I, you know, sent him a message on Twitter. He didn't know me. I don't know him. And I just told him, you know, dude, this thing really, I watched it 3 or 4 times. And we became fast friends, and we talked about, you know, what I was going through in the moment and my experience in the NBA with NBA athletes that had come out about mental health issues. Most prominently, Kevin Love, who good friend and was also on the podcast. What was your feeling about, and I talked to Brett yesterday, we had a really great talk about you and the documentary, but what was your feeling when you were presented with the idea of being in The Weight of Gold? Was it like something that you saw as a great opportunity to move the needle on the mental health issues with athletes?
I did. I saw. And actually, the real impetus of how I got involved with the project was because two of my friends, Sasha Cohen, the figure skater, and Jeremy Bloom, the NFL athletes who also made the Olympic team in downhill moguls freestyle, was chatting with them and talking to them about this kind of incredibly difficult transition that all of us face, particularly in the Olympic realm, because there was a lack of resources that weren't there to support athletes when they do transition or even during that process of becoming an Olympic athlete. And I think that this incredibly focused and hyper non-distractive environment that people live in is very powerful on one side of the coin. And on the other side of the coin, it's very lonely. and there's tons of expectations and all the things that we know around kind of trying to be your best and standing on the stage to represent 300 plus million Americans who watch and cheer you on and having that on your back. But there's all these kind of internal challenges that I think both the Olympic athletes face, the Olympic hopefuls face. And part of the reason why I was really passionate about it is I felt that there needed to be a story that was told, not to say and plead or point fingers, but basically to show, hey, we are human beings who do extraordinary physical feats of performance. And while we all have this external display of complete abundance, internally, this mind, which has proven to be our most powerful tool, is also a self-destructive tool if not used appropriately or guided in the right way. And by no fault of any organization, we just didn't have the tools according. We didn't think about that, right? There was really a kind of a mentality of you're an Olympic athlete, you train, you wear the toughness on the exterior, and whatever you're managing, you hold that with inside you. And there was no talk of vulnerability to strength. There was no talk of gratitude and empathy. And as we know and learn so much more about that process as an athlete and beyond, when you transition out of that Olympic phase, what I call the great divorce from your first true love into the next path and career, that was a visceral experience. And so I felt it was very important for me to be open and transparent and show to the world and say, like, hey, there was many times in my life and in my career, both during and after, where there was a lot of internal trauma and psychological pain that existed. And that could go towards a downward spiral, which then results in this kind of toxic self-talk that many people have, or self-sabotage in a certain perspective. And I think that there's a better way. I think that there's a more open society that is willing and open to learning about those people that we place on pedestals who aren't allowed to have those types of feelings. They aren't allowed to be human. They aren't allowed to not be okay. And that's what the film embodies and showcases. There is a weight. There is a consequence to every action that we do. And by our own choosing, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that the conversation to move the needle forward is really important. And so we know how important mental health is in our day-to-day lives. And sport is no different than that, right? It's one of those things where it is the ultimate expression of the physicality of a human being, but also showcases the power of the mind to overcome and be disciplined and to have the routines and all these great attributes that we build through character. That's why we love sports, right? It's kind of the real life kind of saga of what happens when you kind of script out the amazing race or this amazing story. And beneath that curtain, I think there's another story to be told. And I think that Brett and the team and everyone involved did a great job of that.
Paul, were you surprised when you started, you know, talking to other athletes? I mean, you mentioned Sasha and Jeremy, but, you know, with Michael Phelps and some of the other athletes that were involved in the film, but also, you know, Shaun White, you know, Brett talked about that he booked you and Shaun the same day and you kind of overlapped and you were chatting for a while. Was it a surprise to you? Because, you know, you talk about this sort of loneliness of an emptiness, I guess, while you're competing and post-retirement, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of friends in the Olympic world and in the world of sports, but the more you talk to people, did it seem like this was a bigger issue than you thought and needed to be addressed?
It was. I retired in 2010 in February. It was the last time that I was actually on the ice. And I knew right away that I was deeply afraid of not finding a passion or something that would propel me in the same way that sport did. And what I found to be the commonality amongst all of the athletes is that the transition was really hard, really hard. And it doesn't go away. But you're always fighting your old conditioned self. And as you want to reinvent and transform into the newest version of who you are and who you desire to become, you're always going to be battling the old system, which you were taught. And so I was surprised. I was surprised to find so many of my friends really struggle. I do think it's changing. And I think that the fact that we're all having these open conversations, by the way, like most of my teammates, Andrew, they didn't even know what was going on in my head. Most of my coaches, right? Because I portrayed this machine-like training environment that I never showed emotion. I never showed any type of pain. And if I did, I used that as fuel. Now, that's great in one leverage of society But on the other side is that can have an internal kind of combustion that may not be the most healthy for your overall trajectory of life. And I think that that's why these important conversations are so important. And now that the transition is happening, you know, the transition around talking around not just about mental health, about the way that you approach your career, your friendships, your self-development, your finances, your business, your entrepreneurship, your hunger for learning. This opens up the entire realm to what actually makes you a healthy, productive, and fulfilled human at the end of the day. And I think maybe that's what the COVID silver lining was to show that life can be so fleeting, that we are just kind of these specks on this planet floating through space, floating through galaxy. And so the camaraderie and the partnerships and the connections are so incredibly important. And we miss those things because we took them for granted for this, for so long. Even the simplistic thing of having a breath and being able to breathe properly. And I think when we have perspective, it changes everything. It changes how we view the world. It changes how we interact with sport, with business, with our money, with friends, with family and loved ones. And hopefully we can continue this when the world really truly opens up.
Yeah. Well, Kevin Love talked so eloquently about the fact that, you know, his mantra is everybody's going through something. And when he opened the floodgates, you know, of course, DeMar DeRozan came forward and other guys came forward. Paul George came forward in the bubble and took a lot of heat for it. You know, athletes are put on this pedestal, like you said. They're not supposed to be human beings. You know, they're just supposed to perform, win a medal, win a championship, get a hat, you know, go in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, you guys are all human. Like, you know, I go through this stuff, too. I've been going through it for 40 years. So I think, you know, and you came out recently in support of Naomi Osaka, who was very vocal as to what her issues were. Took a lot of heat for it, especially from tennis, you know, from the governing bodies. But then, you know, they backed off. I think the more it's talked about and the more it's put out in the open and more that athletes like yourself at the highest level can be raising these issues. I mean, do you feel like that's your mission now? I mean, I know you have business ventures and other things you're doing, but, you know, human to human, you know, is this kind of what your mission is?
My life mission and my purpose has shifted. It once was to pursue things that maybe at One Elm was really selfish. It was about me reaching the podium. Mm-hmm. And upon my transition beyond, I found that the most fulfilled that I got was by seeing others also climb up out of their hole, figuring out ways to go through the darkness to see light and figuring out ways to really persevere. And we as human beings contain this incredibly powerful component, which allows us to survive and then eventually thrive. But it isn't without the scarring and the challenges associated. And so we do need to have these deeper conversations. I tweeted at Naomi mainly because I was like, look, you know what is best for you. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what anyone else is telling you, your federation, sponsors, et cetera, yourself, your family, and your well-being is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm supportive of that because I know how important that is. We've seen so many times the athletes go through this silently and not be outspoken. And we know what the outcome is at the end of the day. And it's ugly. Mm. It's pretty. And we cannot afford to lose any more people to this disease, to this situation, to this internal psychological battle that we all face. Mm-hmm. And so while on the outside, we are progressing, and we're growing and there's tremendous opportunities internally. We also have to live in a world of abundance. And that means being free from expectation, being free from these kind of outside principles of telling you or distracting you what is shiny and what's good. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really view this as a paradigm shift in society, I hope. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to be a part of that, to help people grow and learn and become the best version of themselves, because that's what makes me happy. That's what feels like I can impact this world through all of the experiences that I've had, either through my own personal struggles with transition and reinvention and identity, figuring out what I was going to do next in my life beyond just the Olympic realm, and being hungry to learn, being not afraid to fail, and learning that the most incredible, powerful tool we have is picking ourselves back up mm-hmm. through the help of others or individually after we've been knocked down or after we haven't hit that mark. And those are lessons learned through sport that we carry on into our next career paths.
Mm. I'm wondering, have you read Jerry West's book, his autobiography, by any chance? It's an amazing
no,
book.
I haven't.
You know, Jerry came out, I think it was 2009, 10, the book was released, talking about his mental health struggles. The subtitle of the book is called West on West, My Charmed and Tortured Life. And he laid it all out there. I mean, we're talking about the logo here, you know. And it was kind of like pushed under the rug at the time. Mental health and sports, nobody really, you know, it wasn't a thing. Nobody cared about it. But, you know, Jerry and I have talked. We talked on the podcast, and he was so grateful that Kevin Love, like, sort of took the mantle in the world of basketball. And now, you know, with you and Michael Phelps and Sasha and everyone else who are really speaking up. I mean, for me, as a dad also, you know, it's just important that we don't ignore the mental health aspects. Paul, I want to ask, when you made the transition, when you put, you know, you hung up the skates for good, you know, you're not competing anymore. Was there a grieving process involved? Like you just missed everything that had been so familiar, the competitiveness,
Andrew, I miss it every day.
Yeah.
I miss it every day. That's not going to go away.
Right.
And that's more of coming to terms with the fact that I've decided no longer to put those outfits on mm-hmm. and put on those skates and go race and train. Mm-hmm. Now, in the other respect, I can go out there and try to win in other areas of my life, as mm-hmm. aforementioned before, about how do I help other people win in their own prospective Olympic Games, right? In their own minds, in their own career paths.
Yeah.
That's what the new Chase is all about.
Yeah, I love that. That's fabulous. I mean, in the recovery world, we talk about, you know, once you stop doing what you've been doing, your drug of choice, you know, is put away and you're sober, that there's a grieving process. It's like, oh, I missed my best friend, the whatever it was, you know, that got me through the last number of years.
Yep.
But we get through that. And then we, you know, like you said, be of service. And that is the best thing we can all do. Right. So what's next for you, man? You know, I know that you went to speak to a lot of the athletes at the Winter Olympic Training Center, and you're going to Tokyo. You're going to be there representing the U.S. I mean, in what capacity, and, you know, how does that all fit?
So every Olympic Games, I typically go with NBC, and I do some broadcasting, or I'll mm-hmm. do 3 days in Tokyo. What is it like here? What has changed? What are the new sports? Who are some of the athletes to watch, et cetera? For me, it's like a homecoming to sport. I love it. And then hopefully I get some chances to speak to some of the athletes one-on-one and ask them what their plans are for after the games. But mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to the games.
So when you were recently in Salt Lake, or you were in wherever the Olympic Training Center was, I saw you.
Yeah. In Utah.
Utah. So did you get to speak to athletes in your sport, but, you know, overall, did you talk about these deep issues of mental health and not to, you know, put that aside, to have it, you know, it'd be just as much a part of your training as your, you know, actual sport training?
Every time I go to Utah, I try to sit down with the team and talk to them about some area of the mindset of sport. Mm-hmm. This particular trip wasn't involving around mental health specifically, but we have touched upon those things in the past. And it's a very young team. And that's why it's really important for me to kind of articulate the things that are the most important to them, to have fun, to play the game, to enjoy it for all those things, and also dedicate themselves, because the life lessons learned through sport are really powerful. Mm-hmm. And as they are ready to transition beyond, to really cultivate and use and hone those skills they've learned through the path mm-hmm. into the next area and stage of their life, because mm-hmm. they are so incredibly critical. And those life lessons we often forget about as we go and transition beyond sport.
So do you feel that it's, you know, the federations, USOC, you know, professional sports organizations, to be more proactive and really treat mental health as truly part of the holistic athlete, right? I mean, for years, it just wasn't part of it. You know, I went to the NBA transition program, which is like 3 days, and they back in the day, they didn't really even talk about mental health. You know, they talked about money. They talked about, you know, keeping women out of the way, you know, all that stuff. But hopefully now that's changed. I mean, is that what you think has to change? It has to start at the beginning?
I think it has to start at the beginning. I also think that there actually is not enough talk around money and mental health. Mm-hmm. The data is there, and we've seen that, that typically we've seen that while it's no sheer direct lineage here, right, in terms of the connection, but typically money causes a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing wrong with talking about finances in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. But I do think that at the core principle decision-making process of understanding, hey, these kids, these people, these adults, it can affect anyone and anyone. So that's why it's really important, particularly in those who feel like they are losing a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that seems to be a common denominator amongst all these things. When you have that sense of purpose, you're willing to, at times, go through suffering because mm-hmm. you know that there is some sort of a metric tied to that. You know that there's a reason why you're going to have these struggling and challenging times. Mm-hmm. It's when you suffer without having purpose, as per Viktor Frankl, you don't no longer believe you have meaning. And that's when it gets very, very dangerous.
Mm. Wow, that's so well said, man. Thank you. So, Paulo, did you ever have a chance to meet Kobe? Did you ever cross paths with him in any way?
Cross paths with Kobe. I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Any memory, any story you can share with us?
Kobe was he was a maverick.
Yeah.
You know, during the training that I saw him in, he seemed to operate within his own bubble. You know, he would communicate with the other athletes and the other mm-hmm. teammates, but mm-hmm. he was very much in his own head for a lot of the times that I saw him preparing and training. He also seemed like he took training very seriously, which I like.
Yeah. Well, so much that I've read and heard and watched you speak about, and even in this time we've had together, you know, the pillars of the Mamba mentality seem to be like right there as things that you live. I mean, Kobe, you know, his four pillars were obsession, curiosity, relentlessness, and strength, right? That those summed up the Mamba mentality, and always going further than what your potential is. And, you know, it was a great legacy to leave us with. You know, we all miss him, of course. And I had the good fortune to work with him for 20 years, be around him. We did a book together, you know, I mean, what a gift that was.
Amazing.
I had that. Yeah. So I just want to tie this up with what's going on with you right now. I know you got a book that's like in the works, right? Going to come out at some point in the next, whatever, you know, number of months. What's that process like, writing this book? I know that you've written books before, but
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you dedicate a certain amount of time, or you just fit it in when you can? How does that work for you?
The book is very important. The book is called Hard Pivot. It's mm-hmm. about reinvention, adaptation, loss of identity, and learning to find and thrive and survive throughout a very chaotic, disruptive world. Mm. And it's dedicated towards anyone who would be struggling with reinvention, who's looking for a new path, who seeks to go deeper, I think, internally, mm. and question if the current path that they are on is actually beneficial to their overall wealth, mentally, physically, financially, et cetera. Mm. And
can't
so this book
that,
is,
man.
Yeah. It's the book is almost done. It'll come out next year.
Awesome.
And it's been a great process. You know, it really has been a part of everything that I stand for, mm-hmm. everything that I believe in. And it provides hopefully some toolkits and exercises and some activities and things that I've found to help me throughout this redefining process as we seek to transform ourselves from 1.0 mm-hmm. into 2.0.
Yeah, I love it, Paulo. I please put me on the list. I gotta talk to Aaron.
Absolutely.
Get me a copy in advance, because we'll have to have another conversation. And then what you're doing in the financial world with personal capital. Can you talk about that? Because that sounds super interesting to me.
Yeah, personal capital. It's a great relationship and partnership where effectively what we're trying to do is kind of threefold. One, get people to have a home base and a dashboard so that they understand how they're spending, how this impacts their life on a day-to-day basis, and using the metrics and data that they have by plugging in your credit cards, your bank statements, et cetera, in a way that allows you to actually have what we call this dashboard, this home base. All these things are free tools that they offer to really any consumer. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to be a client of Personal Capital in order to access these things, but they really believe that the, call it the, the financial literacy component of allowing us to have greater controls and greater oversight over how we live our life from a financial means and the conversation around that, right? So like growing up for me, money was very interesting because my father viewed it merely as a means of bartering for time, food, place to sleep, and rent for his salon, right? And I think that we have varying skewed versions of how we talk about money in general. And money has typically been tied to some component of mental health. And so we know that one pillar can be managed appropriately, and it allows us to kind of wipe away the noise. And just like anything in our life, we can do anything that we want, but we can't do everything. And so with this kind of influx of opportunities that arrive in 2021 and beyond, it's really important for us to have these types of metrics that keep us at home base, that keep us focused on the true north, and allow us to make sure that is this and how does this fit in my world in the best way possible. So personal capital embodies a lot of those principles for me. And, you know, it's very, very, kind of, it makes me smile to know that both the operational management, the team, the executives on board of the organization believe in these types of financial tools to help people make better decisions on a day-to-day basis. And I believe that eventually that will help them actually live a healthier mentally and physically prosperous life. So
yeah, man, that's great stuff. I mean, because, you know, stress over financial stuff obviously affects everything from top to bottom of your mental health. I wasn't brought up with any financial literacy whatsoever, you know, and God bless my parents, but they, you know, it was just impulsive. You know, they wanted it, they bought it. You know, there was no kind of any kind of teaching. And of course, I never learned that in college, and I never learned it in life. And I learned it the hard way, actually, by failure and having to pick myself up and figure it out, you know. So it's wonderful that you're given this world, but this next generation, hopefully, some tools. And I applaud you on that, man. Can't thank you enough for coming on the Legends of Sport podcast. You mean a true legend of sport. I was looking forward to this conversation for a long time. And it's great to meet you, you know, virtually, but in person. I hope that our paths
cross. Great to meet you too.
Yeah, man.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I hope
I'll get you the book.
Yeah, dude, I have to get the book. All right. I'll trade you books. I don't know if you have the mom's book, but I will definitely trade Aaron, and I'll work that out.
All right. I like it. I like
but,
it. That's
a good really, plan. Really great connecting with you. Have a really great summer. Good luck to the team over there in Tokyo. I hope, you know, God willing, health wise, everybody's okay. I have some friends going over to cover it, and you know, everybody's worried, but let's hope it all comes off without a hitch. And I hope we can cross paths again soon, man. Thanks so much.
Amazing. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Wow, that was such a fun interview and conversation with the iconic Apollo Ohno. You know, you talk about legends of sport. You don't get too more legendary than that guy. And I really, really appreciate the time he took to talk to us about everything from mental health and sports, transition from sport to life, financial literacy. Man, such a great conversation. So thank you to Apollo. Huge thanks to his guy, Aaron Marion, who continues to bring great guests to the Legends of Sport podcast. So thank you, Aaron, for being a great friend of the LOS podcast. Also, thanks to my researcher and my producer, Veronica Ahn. Terrific job on this podcast, as always. And thank you to everyone for continuing to download and subscribe to our podcast. Reminder that you can find us on the LA Times app and online, as well as your favorite podcast platforms, including Apple and Spotify. Please keep following us on Instagram at Legends of Sport. Our Twitter is at @Legends_of_Sport. Our blog, legendsofsport.blog, and our TikTok and YouTube channels, Legends of Sport. You can find my photography, as always, on Instagram at ADB Photo Inc. So a huge thanks again to Apollo, to Aaron, Veronica, and all of you for tuning in today, downloading. Keep telling your friends, because we're going to keep bringing great guests to you guys every 2 weeks. Keep checking our social media, and we'll be back with another guest on the Legends of Sport podcast. Until then, stay safe and be well.